From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
A Democratic governor and a Democratic legislature. You'd expect smooth sailing on climate change policy, but you'd be wrong. What happened to the governor's signature climate change legislation, and why? We'll ask. Ron Lapsley, the president of the California Business Roundtable. Juan Altamirano, the associate director of public policy for Audubon, California. John Myers, KQED's senior editor for California Politics and Government. And Dan Walters of the Sacramento Bee. Climate change legislation. Has the political climate changed? We'll also hear from Dr. Roger Bales, professor of engineering at UC Merced, Dr. Tapan Patek, a research professor at UC Merced specializing in climate adaptation in agriculture, and Pete Weber, a former Fortune 500 executive.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report, with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
California's groundbreaking climate change legislation has or will impact almost every Californian in big and small ways. What are the concerns of California's business community as we attempt to tackle the problem of climate change? Our guest is Rob Lapsley, the president of the California Business Roundtable. Welcome.
Good morning.
So California seems to have taken the lead on climate change. Do you see that as a competitive advantage or disadvantage?
So California is clearly a global leader in climate change. We are so far ahead of any other state, nation, or jurisdiction that the governor has been out working to bring them along with us in order to be able to tackle this problem. So is it a competitive advantage? We see this issue, number one, as something that needs to be addressed. So we need to be clear about that. Okay. The business community agrees that climate change needs to be addressed. The question that comes into this on a policy basis is how? How?
The devil's always in the details.
Always. And the details matter, and we have been working diligently with the policymakers on what those details look like. So everything that's moving forward on climate change is all about how you do it, not whether you need to do it.
Yeah. It's interesting. Some industries, though, are going to do quite well with this climate change legislation. One of them is the solar industry. With this move toward the clean energy mandate, they're going to do pretty well with this new legislation, aren't
wind,
they?
Wind, I mean, but they get subsidies to do that.
Right.
So, you know, that's a little different business model than how
specific.
We get there.
Right. I mean, my understanding is that the solar industry in California is about $11 billion. And they're talking with this new legislation of anywhere between $8 and $10 billion more, almost doubling the size. So that's pretty significant. So listen, there are two pieces of major legislation that the governor and the legislative leaders wanted but didn't get. One was to cut fuel use by 50% by 2030, and the other was to roll back greenhouse gas emissions to 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. It's a mouthful. What was the basis for the business community's opposition to those two things?
Again, it goes back to the how. It's all about how does it get done. And what are the safeguards to ensure, because we are so far out in front, that we ultimately do not become uncompetitive in terms of being able to attract business and create jobs? So when you look at where California is, our energy rates are a big factor in where job creation takes place. So we as a community have been working closely to talk about, look, when you set these goals and then you put them in law, we have to have some safeguards so that if we have a major downturn in the economy or our energy rates take off in a way that are maybe as an unintended consequence, we have to be able to know that we can come back to the legislature or the regulatory agencies and say, okay, we need to slow some pieces down. We have too great a rate increase on our California families or on the businesses. And those safeguards were the big topic of the discussion.
It sounds like you're really, if I can synthesize it down to two things, you're looking at a cost-benefit analysis, and you're looking at kind of a safety valve in case things happen that you're unintended consequences, which is always the problem with the legislation. You can't predict the future. Let me ask you this, though. One of the big issues was the role of the ARB, the Air Resources Board. Some want to limit the ARB's ability to write regulations. Others say, and want to give it to the legislature, others say, no, don't give it to the legislature because you'll just politicize an issue that really is a scientific issue. What do you think?
So When you look at this, again, let's start from kind of a foundation. What we pay for fuel in California averages about 75 to 85 cents above the national average, okay, for a variety of reasons. All about clean air, which has been a phenomenal success in California. Our energy rates are significantly higher than our surrounding states, and particularly when you look across the nation, anywhere from 5 to 10 to 15 cents a kilowatt hour. So we start with that as what we pay for our leadership in this. So then you look at, with AB 32 that passed in 2006, we're just starting to get the cost information on what is happening under that. There hasn't been a strong cost-benefit analysis yet from the original legislation, and now we've just passed the next generation legislation under SB 32.
Sounds like the business community wants to catch their breath and see where we are.
Well, we're arguing that, and we're trying to show that we need to do all of this at the same time. You cannot, unless you have a good base of information of what's happening, you have to be careful about what you do with the next generation. That's why SB 32 didn't pass.
Yeah, it's interesting. Let me ask you about this, though. The Little Hoover Commission did a report a while ago, and they said, listen, in terms of limiting greenhouse gases, lots has been done, but not a lot has been done about adapting to the impacts of climate change. Should we be focusing more on the impacts of climate change?
So we should, and also I look at that from two things. One is, when we talk about our climate change leadership, what we don't see is a connection of the dots. And how I define that is, why are we not the largest single manufacturer that's creating thousands of jobs for all these new green technologies? Green jobs are 2% of the economy. We're trying to look out for the other 98%. Then you couple that with the mitigation impacts. Why do we not have the largest public works program building new water storage, for example?
That's
because we are going to need it under the climate change impact.
That's one of the impact
issues.
There's
for the
sure.
politics of it.
Right.
But you can't do both and not have unintended consequences.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for providing a business perspective on California's climate change actions. So what are the environmental what is the environmental perspective on California's climate change actions? That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report. Addressing the challenges posed by climate change has galvanized the environmental community. So what do they think about California's attempts to tackle the problem of climate change? Too much, too little, or just right? Our guest is Juan Altamirano, the Associate Director of Public Policy for Audubon, California. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
So environmentalists didn't get everything they wanted in the last legislative session, but they still got a lot. A 50% increase in energy efficiency in buildings, a requirement that California get half of its electricity from renewable resources by 2030, and you fended off an attempt to weaken the regulatory authority of the Air Resources Board, the ARB. So half a loaf, better than none at all?
Well, certainly the environmental community has thrived on a slow and steady pace over the last several years. And we realize you don't change the political landscape of a state that has 38 million people overnight. The last time the state renewable energy portfolio standard was that when it was updated, it took years of political battle. And this year, we're happy to say that it was done in one fell swoop. The other thing that I think is really important to remember is that while certainly we didn't get everything that we wanted, we were able to pass other landmark legislation in climate adaptation bills this year, which are going to be heading to the governor's desk and are critically important to helping the state adapt to this critical topic.
You know, I want to talk to you about adapting to climate change. Little Hoover Commission did a report a while ago, and they said, hey, California's done a great job of focusing on lowering greenhouse gases, but they really haven't focused on the impact of climate change. Do you think the state should be doing more on that issue?
Absolutely. I think that the state should be addressing the issue of adaptation and climate change. The governor took a huge step forward on adaptation this year by releasing an executive order on requiring the Natural Resources Agency to update the state's climate change adaptation plan and adding adaptation to the state's infrastructure planning.
So the governor is doing something in that direction. Does the legislature need to do something?
So we sponsored a bill with Assemblymember Gordon, AB 1482, that currently is at the governor's desk, codifying exactly this, this executive order of creating a statewide climate adaptation policy for the first time in history.
So it starts as an executive order, then it moves to legislation. And that happens a lot, by the way. That's not an unusual path for a bill to come into being. You know, there's also a lot of talk about maybe some of this action is going to be happening at the regional or local level. Is that what you see?
Certainly. Very similarly, you know, the legislature took action with Senator Jackson's bill in SB 379, which is signed into law. If signed into law, local governments will finally have the opportunity to incorporate climate adaptation planning into their general plan. So certainly you're seeing a step in that direction, having the legislature push forward these initiatives.
Yeah, local communities, you know, if you're in, you know, an area where they're prone to fire, dealing with issues where you know you're going to have more forest fires, or if you're in an area that's impacted by drought, like an ag community is doing something to deal with water. I mean, those are kind of local impacts that we know are happening and we can take some action to address them. I'm wondering, do you see any middle ground here? Where do you see progress around climate change going forward?
Well, I think that one of the things, sticking points this year certainly was that 50% petroleum reduction debate.
My understanding, though, is we're already going to get to, just with better cars and whatnot, we're going to already be at 35% reduction. So we're really only talking about 15% more.
Exactly. And so I think the important thing to remember is that Californians as a whole are behind making the cars that are on the road. Cars on the road be more efficient. Mm-hmm. The cleaner the vehicle standards passed, the clean vehicle energy standards passed by Senator Pavley in 2009 have been the number one most effective program, according to the Air Resources Board, in reducing petroleum consumption and improving air quality. And I think the second part of this equation is that the state as a whole is cognizant and really recognizing that there is an important aspect of not only cleaning up, making our cars more efficient, but making sure that we serve those that are most impacted, communities of color.
The poor communities.
Yes, poor communities, and making sure that that those impacts are lessened and reduced on those communities.
But that's one of the arguments, though, against a gas tax increase. They say, well, it's going to impact poor communities. That was one of the arguments against reducing gas consumption by 50%. Some of the moderate Democrats were saying, and most of them are from the Valley, were saying it was going to impact their communities, their poor communities more.
The thing that I would say is that we need to help these communities improve their local local air quality and increase their access to recreational opportunities like parks, rivers, wetlands, et cetera, so we can have a healthier, more livable community. That's something that we certainly embrace within the environmental community, but I think business as a whole also would agree with that.
Well, I want to thank you for that environmental perspective on California's climate change actions. Up next, the politics of climate change with two of the most respected observers of state politics, Dan Walters from the Sacramento Bee and John Myers from KQED. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Governor Brown has made addressing climate change one of the key goals of his administration. And by and large, he's been pretty successful getting almost everything he's wanted, but not this time. So where does Governor Brown go from here? We've got two of the best Capitol observers to join us to talk about that and other things. John Myers, KQED's senior editor for California Politics and Government, and Dan Walters from the Sacramento Bee. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, John, let's start with you. Republican opposition was expected on this climate change legislation. The governor seemed to have real problems with moderate Democrats, and many of them are from the Valley. Did the governor make a tactical mistake by not working more closely with the mods?
Well, in one way. I mean, I think, though, you have to broaden it out, though, Mark, and you look at not just the governor, you look at the Democratic leadership in the state Senate, which took these goals. I mean, the governor put these goals about renewable energy, energy-efficient buildings, and petroleum use in cars. That was the real bill we were fighting over. Took all those goals and put them in his inauguration speech. The Democrats in the state Senate memorialized them into legislation. But that legislation never really seemed to find any way to negotiate. I mean, especially on the petroleum issue. And I think you know, I think there are some questions in the Capitol about how much the governor felt like he really needed the bill or didn't need the bill. I mean, you know, he has a lot of regulatory authority, which we can talk about. And so, yeah, I think there may have been a little miscalculation, but don't underestimate the ability of the oil industry to make a very powerful argument and to make sure that its argument is heard.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Dan, the role of ARB seemed to be a big stumbling block in negotiations. There was one side that argues that ARB is just a bunch of unelected bureaucrats that need to be reined in. There's the other side of the equation that argues that we don't want legislature dealing with this because they're just going to politicize something that really is a scientific issue. But is that really not what's going on here? What's really going on here is this fight between the executive branch and the legislative branch, this age-old fight?
No, I don't think it really is so much a legislative executive branch thing. Look, you start talking about people's cars, their ability to drive, the cost of driving. You're talking about something that's quintessential. It's part of the fabric of California. And if you start messing around with that, you better have some good answers when people start raising questions about it. They didn't have any answers because they're saying, well, we're going to do that. We're going to cut by 50% by 2030. At the same time, by the way, we want to raise your gas taxes. And, okay, so then you ask the question, well, how are you going to do this? How is it going to be done? They said, well, we could do a little of this, we could do a little of that, we could do a little of this. We could, but what do you really propose for us, we drivers? Mm-hmm. And that, I think, resonated. The oil industry exploited that. And in the poorer areas of the state, without a lot of transit facilities, places like the Central Valley and the Inland Empire, people are absolutely dependent on their cars. The incomes are not high, and they're very sensitive to the idea of something that you're going to mess around with me. And you're not telling me what you're going to do. You're just going to tell me what the final result is. Tell me what you're going to do. And, well, they never answered that question.
And I think it's so interesting, Mark, that you, like, we look at what happens in courtrooms, or we watch television shows, right? And we see lawyers talk about reasonable doubt. Like, you just have to insert enough reasonable doubt. And the oil industry did a very good job, in my opinion, of inserting reasonable doubt into the bill with mm-hmm. those members of the legislature, and even, frankly, with some members of the public, that just there was no way to get around.
So it was a, kind of a beyond a reasonable doubt
there's
standard.
One other thing in here. That mod block or in the assembly has been cultivated over the years with something like this in mind. And business groups have gone out and they've played in the top two primary system and whatnot, and they've developed this group of moderate Democrats who now hold basically the balance of power in the legislative system.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, John, the governor is, it was interesting in his quotes. He has
He's always interested in his quotes.
His zeal has been intensified to a maximum degree. And the other thing he said, we're still on track. And you were talking about, you know, regulations that they actually can get a long way toward that 50% reduction in gas use. Just dealing with regulations, forget legislation. Is that where we're headed? More regulations, less legislation?
I mean, I think the governor sees the writing on the wall. I mean, I think in a way that, you know, while the governor was disappointed probably that he didn't get the legislation, he's got this great foil now in the oil industry and the battle that he has picked on climate change. And yes, the Air Board has a tremendous amount of power. The governor controls it. It's part of the executive branch. This gets back a little bit to that executive branch issue. Regulation is a big deal. I think, though, you know, a lot of people would like to see more than regulatory power. They want statutory power. Because when one governor leaves and another governor comes, you don't know for sure that the regulations last. But yeah, I think we're going to get that.
You have to also understand that there has been some kickback on how the ARB has operated in the past. They've been rather arbitrary and decreeing this and that and the other and then kind of expecting the public to accept it without really making much of a public case for what they're doing. They're just doing it, saying this is what we need to do, and they're not really going out there and selling what they're doing.
Okay, well, up next is the political climate on climate change about to change. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking to Dan Walters with the Sacramento Bee and John Myers with KQED and the California Politics Podcast. So, Dan, climate change is a major initiative of Senate Leader De Leon. Do you think we'll be seeing more major legislation coming out of the state legislature in the next year?
More major legislation coming out of the state legislature this year? I think what you're going to see is a continuing division between the two houses. The funny thing about these two legislative houses is that at any one point, one of them tends to generate a lot of legislation and the other one's kind of reactive.
And it goes back and forth.
And right now, at the moment, the Senate is being the generator and the Assembly is being reactive. The Senate overall is several notches to the left of the Assembly right now, and there's that friction. So yes, there may be major legislation, but it has to overcome that split between the two houses. Particularly, it has to overcome this considerable block of moderate Democrats, maybe as many as 20, who really have the balance of power now in the legislature. And I tell you, the fact that Tony Atkins, the Speaker of the Assembly, could not get them to follow the governor is an indication of the relative situations in the two houses.
John, I'm wondering, what about SB 32, Pavley's legislation, right. 80% reduction in gas emissions below 1990 levels by 2050? She's saying she's going to bring that back. What are your thoughts on that?
I believe she will. I mean, and I think, you know, I think a couple of things would be interested in 2016, Mark. I mean, first of all, in some ways, I think the discussion over the Pavley legislation, which is an extension of the current climate change law, got overshadowed by this fight about the other bill, about the petroleum use and the renewable energy and everything else. So it didn't get maybe the full discussion it needed in some ways. 2016 is an election year, and you know you're going to hear something about these issues and climate issues and all of that. And I fully believe she'll bring it back. I think it'll be a good debate to watch.
Well, there's also the proposition route.
Yep.
You know, we got 2016, presidential election, more Democrats are likely to come out to the polls. You might see environmentalists like Tom Steyer pushing something. Will we be seeing?
Well, I mean, the guy's got a lot of money, right? I mean, you know, if you've got a lot of money and you've got an issue in California, you can have a campaign. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to win, but you can have a campaign. And I suspect Steyer wants to continue to drive the point home. You know, one thing interesting, Mark, in the summertime, he stood out at a press conference in Los Angeles and talked about we need transparency in how gas prices are set in California. It was seen as a bit of a shot across the bow to the oil industry about the climate change stuff. I would not be surprised to see Mr. Steyer come back and make those kind of cases, and the voters would eat up something about gas prices.
Although if the gas prices continue to fall in California, that becomes a little less viable. But it's actually getting kind of late to start new ballot measures. I mean, if you have a ballot measure for the 2016 ballot, you should be out there with it right now. Basically.
But if you have a lot of money, you can do it.
Yeah,
fast.
But the threshold,
you can overcome,
the threshold
you can
is lower,
it.
Though, right?
Yeah.
And to get the number of voters you need to sign up to get it on the ballot is lower.
Relatively low because of the low turnout in last year's election. But it's a possibility. But remember, rich guys have tried to get involved in politics before in California without conspicuous success.
Right.
I mean, the carcasses are littered, you know, along the way.
Let me ask you this in terms of climate change and how it's impacting the state's water situation, Dan. You know, big push, certainly from folks in the valley about above-ground storage dams. But you're seeing, you know, this historic lack of snowpack. In addition, the success of conservation, is that hurting the case for dams?
It may be hurting the case for dams. There's a lot of things going on in water right now because of the drought. For example, Southern California is becoming much more self-reliant on water. They need less and less water from the north because they've built reservoirs, because they're doing reclaiming, their desalination and whatnot. So that's one thing that's going on. The other thing, the question is, if in fact climate change does what the experts say it will, which will mean we'll have less snow in the future, but more rain. In other words, maybe the total amount of precipitation won't be different, but it'll be more rain and less snow. Then that changes how you do it. You need to be able to capture that rainfall because you do not have the natural reservoir of a snowpack. And so that changes the whole dynamic. I think I think the whole idea of what you do with water and how you capture it, how you conserve it, how you transport it is undergoing a tremendous change in California right now. Maybe it means we should do more underground storage from the rain rather than trying to capture that, because only the dams really only capture snowfall.
Yeah, ground banking, there's a lot of potential with ground banking. Last question quickly, John. I was to ask you about some of the issues that might get bipartisan support, particularly the impact of climate change, things like dealing with the drought or dealing with wildfires. Is that maybe a new way for the legislature to attack this problem?
I suppose. I mean, always smaller issues are bigger or better to get through the Capitol than larger issues. But, I think the other thing that's interesting, too, is that we don't know what's coming around the bend. I mean, we've all talked about El Nino, for example. We don't know what flooding might do to change the debate and what kind of we do. Is Dan talking about where you use that water? I do think that there is some consensus on some small issues. But these big issues, you've got these splits in the Democratic Party, and that's the thing to watch.
I guess we'll be watching that. I want to thank our guests, John Myers from KQED, Dan Walters from the Sacramento Bee, the California Business Roundtable's Rob Lapsley, the Audubon Society's Juan Altamirano, for joining us. If you want to stay current on state and local politics, you can follow us on the Maddie Report by either looking us up on our website or checking us out on Facebook or Twitter. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views expressed in the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Up next, what impact will California's new climate change legislation have on the Valley? We'll get perspectives from Dr. Roger Bales and Dr. Tapan Patek, professors at UC Merced, and Pete Weber, a former Fortune 500 executive. Welcome back. So what impact will the state's recent climate change laws have on the San Joaquin Valley? We're going to ask Dr. Roger Bales, founding professor of engineering at UC Merced, who's been active in water and climate-related research for over 30 years. Welcome, Dr. Bales.
Pleasure to be here, Mark. Pleasure
to be here. And I'm glad to have you. And Dr. Tapan Patek is an assistant professor at UC Merced specializing in climate adaptation and agriculture. Welcome, Dr. Patek.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, Pete Weber, who's a former Fortune 500 executive and former executive committee chair of the California Partnership for the San Joaquin Valley and now is very involved with California Forward. Welcome back to the show, Pete.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay, so Pete, let me start with you. I want to get your overall assessment of California's climate change legislation. And I'm wondering, is the state implementing the right strategy on really a critical issue, or are we implementing a strategy that will end up hurting the state and the valley economically by simply driving business to places that are willing to allow more pollution?
Well, that's a good question, Mark. Let's start with this. Most Californians believe climate change is a very serious problem. Californians want to be environmental leaders. It's part of our DNA. It's part of our brand, but surveys show that we want to be smart about it. Now, what does it mean to be smart about it? It means that we know that reduction of greenhouse gases is a global challenge. California generates less than 1% of global GHG, so we clearly can't address the challenge by ourselves. We can't lead if others don't follow. We already generate 50% less GHG per capita than the national average. We need other states to catch up, and certainly other nations must do the same thing. In 2013, which is the last year for which we have good data, China alone generated 60% of the growth in global GHG and generated almost twice the GHG generated by the U.S. It also means that as Californians, we want to pursue our environmental goals in parallel with our social and economic goals, not one at the expense of the other. For years, as you know, China pursued its economic goals while disregarding environmental impacts and social impacts, and they're paying the price for that now. But it's equally wrong to pursue environmental goals on the backs of the poorest among us. It's wrong to be hell-bent on reducing our carbon footprint if the net effect is to drive economic activity to areas that have far less rigorous standards than we do, thereby increasing that global GHG. So let me just very quickly say, smart environmental leadership, in my mind, translates into three things, all of which are interconnected. First, we have to prove to ourselves and to others that aggressive environmental goals can be pursued without adversely impacting economic and social goals. Second, we have to be superb at global environmental diplomacy. We have to persuade others to do their part. And third, we have to use our purchasing power, the fact that California is the seventh largest economy in the world, as leverage to encourage other states and nations to meet our standards if they wish to serve our markets.
Okay. Dr. Bales, let me ask you, it sounds a little bit like Pete's laying out a prisoner's dilemma here. What are your thoughts?
Well, I certainly agree with Pete that we have to choose the right strategy. We have to choose a smart strategy as a state for getting there. When our governor attends the Conference of Parties in Paris, that is the last global climate summit that's scheduled between the nations, he will be taking some recommendations from the University of California and other scientists across the state as what are the top 10 things that California is planning to do that the rest of the nation can do to get to a reduction in greenhouse gases, which I think everyone agrees that we need to be proactive. We can't wait for problems to get worse. So I see opportunities for the region. We had SB 350 passed by the legislature that continues the transition of our economy from fossil fuels to clean and renewable energy. That's a given, and we need to figure out how we can be smart and take advantage of that. There other bills will be back, such as SB 32 will be back in the next session, I'm told. So a transition toward renewable energy is a reality, and that's part of what we need to be doing.
You know, Dr. Patek, let me ask you. You're an expert specializing in climate adaptation in agriculture. And a little Hoover Commission did a report a little while ago on climate change, and they suggested that while the state's done a lot to limit greenhouse gases, it hasn't done much to adapt to the impacts of climate change. So what do you see are the most important impacts of climate change here in the Valley, you know, where agriculture is pretty important, obviously?
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. You know, mitigation adaptations measures are equally important. Along with reducing greenhouse gas emissions, we also need to be prepared and be responsive to effects of climate change. So even if we are doing a great effort in mitigating greenhouse gas emissions now, we'll still see temperature increases anywhere between 3 to 5 degrees till the end of the century. So we have also to be very proactive in terms of adaptation practices. In terms of the impacts that we are already seeing in Central Valley, warmer and drier conditions are increasing frequency and intensity of wildfires. Agriculture is one of the major industry for our region. It's a $45 billion industry here. Some of the impacts that we are seeing there, for example, we are seeing less and less chill hour accumulation, which is pretty important for many of the specialty crops. We are also seeing decreased snowpack, which might be, and also earlier snow melt, which might create a lot of challenges for water storage and availability issues. So we definitely have to address adaptation along with mitigation practices. Yeah. And there are many efforts going on.
Yeah, one of the things I read in the Little Hoover Commission report was they're saying that, like you're saying, agriculture is going to be affected because crops that now you can grow here, the climate's going to change, and they're now no longer going to be growing here. They're going to be growing someplace else. And so maybe you have to either change the, you know, through genetics, change the crops so they're more adaptable to a warmer climate or grow them someplace else. Obviously, huge impact on agriculture. Dr. Bales, anything you'd add to that in terms of dealing with the impacts of climate change?
Well, I think about the heat and the effect on people as well as on crops. I mean, I used to live in Tucson, which is a little hotter climate than it is here in the Central Valley, and people had slightly different work schedules to accommodate that, and different design of their homes to accommodate that than we do here in the Valley. So when we talk about adaptation, it's just dealing with you and I and our, you know, our many people who work in the Valley dealing with the heat is going to be a challenge.
You know, Dr. Bales, I want to follow up on, you know, this whole climate change situation and the historic lack of snowpack. You know, there's their problem in terms of water. There's also the success, frankly, of conservation on the positive side. So I'm wondering, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, we need above ground storage dams to deal with climate change. Is that making the argument weaker for above ground storage, that we're having less snowpack and that conservation seems to be a pretty effective way to deal with some of this problem?
Well, think about our snowpack in the Sierra Nevada. On average, the amount of water storage in the snowpack is about equal to half the amount of water that's stored behind dams, our big dams. So it is important on a year-to-year basis. Now, when you have less snowpack, that means you need storage elsewhere. So, yes, we need storage for water supply. We also need storage to contain floods. And if we expect, and we do expect, more intense floods as the and rainfall events and floods as the hydrologic cycle speeds up in a warmer climate, then that puts additional strain on our big dams. We have to be smart about storage too. I think of a report a couple years ago by the California Roundtable on Water and Food Supply. They talk about storage broadly: groundwater storage, snowpack storage, storage in the soil water, and storage behind dams. So although conservation may offset a little bit and maybe quite a bit in some areas, the need for seasonal storage, it's not the only solution. There is no silver bullet for this. But I would say before we ask the public to make these huge investments in dams, and we should do that if they're needed, we need to make sure we've taken care of all the lower cost local options for storage. That is, have we maximized our groundwater storage? Have we done as much as we can to improve snowpack and soil water storage and so forth?
Yeah, you know, Petey, it sounds like Dr. Bales is talking about conjunctive use. You know, the idea that we have to have multiple approaches to storage, whether it's below ground, above ground, maybe conservation, et cetera. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with Dr. Bales and what you just said. I think we need a fully integrated, comprehensive solution. There is no silver bullet. And I think as to the impact of conservation, I think the answer should be pretty obvious about the need for storage, because look at what we've done in just the last year in terms of conservation. Huge, huge increase in conservation and more than 25%. And yet we've got hundreds of thousands of fallowed acres and millions of brown lawns. And so, I mean, we've got to get real. We have got to do a comprehensive, integrated system that takes water, when it is available, stores it, and conveys it to where it is needed, when it is needed, for the benefit of both humans and species, and for the benefit of urban uses, agricultural uses, industrial uses, and so on. Snowpack in our mountain ranges is steadily declining. We have to offset that with man-made storage. There's no question about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Brown is becoming the new green, at least in my neighborhood, and I'm guessing in a lot of people's neighborhoods. People are converting, they're taking their lawns out and converting them to either, synthetic lawns or kind of a drought-tolerant situation. Dr. Paddock, what are your thoughts on that in terms of agriculture and above-ground storage? That's a necessary, something we're going to need if we're going to keep agriculture here in the Valley?
I think absolutely. I mean, if you look at this modeling study, it projects that we are going to see 25% decrease in the snowpack by 2050. But along with this decreasing trend, we are also expected to see more intense flood events. So we have to take advantage of those water and be allocated somewhere else, so that whenever it's a drier than normal condition, so if we are having drought conditions like this one, then we can definitely make use of that water. And our main agriculture is during the summer months, and our precipitation is in the spring and winter time. So we definitely need a better strategy to conserve water and make use of when it is most beneficial.
You know, it is pretty amazing, though, that the state, as Pete mentioned, on average 25% conservation. That it really is. Hats off to the people who have done that. That's pretty amazing. But Dr. Bales, let me jump to this last question in this segment here, because we're running a little bit out of time. I want to ask you about, basically who's going to pay for all this. It seems to be a clear majority agree that something has to be done to address the impacts of climate change. So where do you fall on, who pays for it? That seems to be where the debate is really.
That's you really hit on it. That's the policy question. Remember, I'm the scientist, but we can identify that the benefits of both adaptation and mitigation to our warming climate, those benefits are pretty broad, and it's challenging to recover those broad costs through the market. So we can look to some examples and maybe build on those. I'm aware that the cap and trade program has funds that have been coming into the region for various projects, and that's a instead of a tax, that's a transfer of funds. So I'm hoping that the state can continue to build on those, and that we in the region, our elected officials, can be at the table to make sure that the policies that are in new legislation are attractive. Now, it's also challenging when we look at, there may be some well-established corporations and small businesses that will face challenges as we convert from a fossil fuel-based to a renewable energy economy. And we need to figure out ways to ease that transition, especially for the workers.
Yeah, you know, Mike, and I'm just jumping here. You know, Pete, it was interesting. There was a PPIC poll recently, and it's been pretty consistent, that you know, over 70% of the people say global warming is a very serious or somewhat serious problem. So seem to agree that it's a problem. The question is how to pay for it. So what are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, and the Business Roundtable then looked at some of the data and did another survey that showed that people think it's very important, provided they don't have to pay for it themselves.
Isn't that always the case?
Yeah, the fact of the matter is, Mark, that we really don't understand very well who's paying for it, because most of the payment is through impacts. It's impacts in higher energy costs, higher fuel costs, higher housing costs, and so on. And here we are 9 years after the passage of AB 32, and we have yet to do a rigorous analysis of the impacts of AB 32 so we understand what those impacts are. Yeah. Professor Bales mentioned SB 350, which has passed recently. It passed without anybody really understanding what the impacts are going to be. Who's going to pay for it? You know, what's the impact on seniors, you know, who are on fixed incomes? What's the impact on the poor? My speculation is that when we do that analysis, we're going to find that most of the burden is falling on the middle class.
Yeah. You know, no question that there's costs associated with climate change. But what about the benefits? Is there an economic upside for the Valley? That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
You're listening to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. We're talking to Dr. Roger Bales, founding professor of engineering at UC Merced, who's been active in climate change-related research for over 30 years. Dr. Tapan Patek, an assistant professor at UC Merced, specializing in climate adaptation in agriculture. And Pete Weber, a former Fortune 500 executive and former committee chair of the California Partnership for the San Joaquin Valley, now with California Forward, about the state's recently enacted climate change laws. So let's turn our attention to a related issue, and that is, what impact will it have on the Valley economically? We touched on that a little bit in the earlier segment, but Dr. Bales, I want to go to you and talk about, you know, the Valley, you know, it seems to have some advantages here. It has abundance of sunshine. Don't we have a competitive advantage when it comes to the push for renewables like solar?
I really feel, Mark, that we have some advantages we can really use. For example, the University of California has made a commitment to be carbon neutral on our campuses by 2025. The university really recently invested in an 80 megawatt solar facility near Fresno, and there will be more investments coming. UC Merced is on track to be part of this broader UC goal. Our new buildings at Merced will be carbon neutral, greenhouse gas neutral. A big challenge for the university, you know, is around natural gas. On the electricity side, the market is already there for us to invest in solar facilities. But where do we get our natural gas? Well, the Valley also has, and Valley and Sierra Nevada together, feedstocks that could be used for biogas as well as for electricity production. So these are just a couple of examples where we see, you know, I think investment and business and jobs opportunities, at least things I'm associated with.
So, Pete, a business opportunity?
Well, you know, yes, and but with a couple of cautions. First, you know, we got to be very sensitive not to pave over the most fertile, most productive land of the planet with solar panels. There's only 5 Mediterranean climates in the world that produce the crops we grow in California, and the last I checked, global population was still growing. So, you know, where are we going to get our food? Do we really want to become as dependent on others for food security as we have allowed ourselves to become on energy security? And then the second big question is, solar is still far more expensive than other sources of energy. I visited Wolf Farms recently. They are very socially and environmentally conscious operator. They operate the fifth largest tomato processing plant in the world, and they've made a huge investment in solar, and I was talking to them about it, and they said the only reason it pencils out for them is because the project received subsidies totaling 75% of the cost. Now, if you refer to those as state and federal subsidies, that may not sound too bad, but if you refer to them correctly as taxpayer subsidies, it may not sound so good, particularly when it's middle-class taxpayers that are bearing the brunt of those subsidies. You know, on the other hand, if the project was not subsidized, Wolf Farming wouldn't be able to install solar and remain competitive on world markets. So the answer is, yeah, there's potential opportunities, but with some caveats. And those caveats, again, relate back to that initial question of who else is doing it? You know, if everybody else is on the same pace that we are or close to the same pace, then we can all do it because it doesn't affect competitive situations. But if California is alone out in front, then it's a problem.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that's kind of interesting, that not being a farmer myself, is I was doing a little research on agriculture, and they actually rate the quality of soil. And the soil in the San Joaquin Valley, you know, you always wonder, you know, why are all the crops here? Is it just the water? No, it's actually the soil. The soil is some of the best in the world. And so that's something to think about when you're doing the cost-benefit analysis of some of these issues. But let me kind of jump to another question, Pete, and that is the big issue of this, you know, legislative debates and the role of the ARB, the Air Resources Board, and whether or not they should be making the rules when it comes to climate change. You know, they argue that scientists, these are the professionals, they should make the rules. The other argument is, no, this is really should be left to elected politicians because we're really talking about a policy issue here. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, with all respect to the Air Resources Board and their technical experts, details matter here. We're talking about policy implications here that have enormous consequences on every aspect of life in California. So I don't think they can be left entirely in the hands of an agency run by unelected people. I think the legislature must be allowed to have an oversight role, because this is not purely a technical issue. This is really a policy issue about how we want to live our lives and who gets impacted by the decisions that are made and made sometimes at the detail level.
You know, Dr. Bales, the other side of that argument would be that, you know, we don't want to politicize this issue. Some may say it's already politicized, but what are your thoughts about that? I mean, should we leave this to the scientists? Should we leave it to the politicians, or should some combination?
Well, I mean, there's got to be a role for both. Obviously, the legislature needs to set up the policies. I'm not sure they're the best ones to really plunge into the details. Just like when you need medical care, there's a role for doctors, there's a role for nurses, there's a role for insurance companies to provide the oversight of that. And, you know, if you need your car repaired versus buying a new car. So we really have to look at, do we need a scientist? Do we need an economist to analyze these things? Or are these political questions? Some questions benefit from analysis and better data. Some are some don't.
Yeah. Dr. Paddock, I want to get you in here as well. What are your thoughts on this?
I think I agree with both Pete and Roger. I think it needs to be a more collaborative effort where, you know, the policies are generally at the level of politicians, but, I mean, the scientists and elected officials should work together collaboratively and understanding those issues and why it is important to be implemented into the policies.
You know, one of the problems I see in public policy today is that people can't even agree to the basic facts. And I think that's probably true with climate change as well. That's a problem when you're trying to kind of carve out or create effective policy. Dr. Bales, let me go to you. I want to ask you about, you know, is there a possibility of some bipartisan solution here that people can coalesce around?
Well, I certainly think so. I mean, we've got several pieces to the puzzle here that we need to put together. We need to put together the fact that there are, you know, new jobs being created all over the valley for solar industry, for installations are happening, and in some cases it's very cost efficient. In some cases it doesn't pencil out all the way. But when we look at a couple of the things that I see good bipartisan support for, it's really also around water and the water energy nexus, integrated water management. I think that enjoys bipartisan support. We need to come to solutions of our water problems. If we if we're building dams, we need to look at the hydropower aspects. If we're using groundwater for storage, we need to look at the energy implications of that. So when we bring our institutions together with better information for our decision makers, I don't think there's any dissent on that. Also, our impacts on our forests. When we talk about adaptation to climate warming, we see these tremendous wildfires in the forest. Those have water implications as well as air quality implications on our region. I see tremendous bipartisan support for making our forests more sustainable. And the next question is, well, who's going to pay for it?
It's always a question, isn't it? I want Pete to jump in here.
Well, actually, I see some movement on that. We see beneficiaries on the water side and some interest in making those investments, recognizing that there's green as well as gray infrastructure.
Yeah, let me ask
the policies haven't quite kept up with the talk yet.
Let me ask Pete, though. We only got 1 minute left in the segment. I want to get his perspective. He's very involved with policy issues statewide. So, Pete, what are your thoughts? Do you see any bipartisan solutions out there?
Absolutely, a lot, provided that everybody at the table agrees that we're going to look at all of these policies with the lens, a triple lens. What are the environmental benefits? What are the social impacts? What are the economic impacts? Provided we're doing that, then I see a world of potential opportunity there to do it in a way that's very, that puts us out in front of the rest of the world.
I'm going to leave it at that very positive note, okay? I want to thank Pete Weber with California Forward, Dr. Roger Bales, and Dr. Tappan Pathak with UC Merced. Thanks, all of you, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.